Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter. I am now in Leviticus chapter 27. I'm going to do the first 25 verses of the chapter. I'll entitle this chapter, this section, Redemption of People, Animals, Houses, and Fields. Our context is this. In our last chapter, the last part of the chapter, we talked about curses for breaking the law. So let's start now with chapter 27, verses 1 and 2. The Lord spoke to Moses. We're still at the end of this book, and God's still speaking to Moses at the door of the tent of meeting, which he started doing that in the very first chapter. This whole book was delivered to Moses, sometimes to Moses and Aaron, but mostly to Moses at the doorway of the tent of meeting. God tells Moses, speak to the Israelites and tell them when someone makes a special vow to the Lord that involves the assessment of people, and we'll finish the sentence later, a special vow. What's that? Other translations have it this way. NIV has, with the Holman Christian Study Bible, special vow. The KJV has a singular vow. The NESB has a difficult vow. Well, what this means is a special vow is just when somebody wants to give something to the temple, to the Lord, and he makes a vow to do it. And in this chapter, we're going to see people making vows of people, animals, houses, fields. We're going to start out with the making a vow of dedication of people to the temple, to the tabernacle, to the priest. For example, you might want to dedicate a servant or a son to work at the temple. And so this is how it's done. What was necessary, the priest had to decide how much the vow was worth in case the person wanted to redeem the thing that he had vowed, in case he changed his mind, in other words, and wanted to get it back. Also, a person could vow something to the tabernacle, to the priest, and decide that he wanted to give a money substitute instead. And so the question is how much money? Well, it was the value of the thing plus 20%. Actually, that's very similar to redemption. You give it, and then you buy it back out of hock, so to speak. You have to pay that extra 20%. That's really the same thing as never giving it to start with, but just giving the monetary value. If you liquidated it, it would be an extra 20 cents. Now, Adam Clark said if the thing that was offered was not redeemed in 1 year, it belonged to God forever. You had 1 year right of redemption. I don't know how Clark knows that. Perhaps that's extra biblical in the rabbinic writings. It's not in Leviticus that I know of. Now, when something was given to the priest or to the temple or to the tabernacle, the priest would sell that thing if they needed it. If they didn't want to keep it, they sold it and used the money to repair the temple or to buy something for the priest. Now, if a person was donated to the temple, they weren't sold into slavery, but they could continue all their lives to serve the temple in various ways. Kind of like Samuel was, if you recall. He was dedicated to the temple when Elijah was the high priest. Now, these special vows, these special Thanksgiving offerings to the temple were over and above the expected normal sacrifices, the burnt offerings, the peace offerings, the sin offerings, and all that. Now, let me read you a couple of scriptures that talks about people being dedicated to the temple. I mentioned Samuel. Let's read that. 1 Samuel 1:28. So I, this is Naomi, his mama talking, have also dedicated Samuel to the Lord. As long as he lives, he is dedicated to the Lord, and he worshiped the Lord there. 2 Kings 12:4. Then Joash said to the priest, all the dedicated money brought to the Lord's temple, census money, that's head tax money, half shekel, money from vows, and all money voluntarily given for the Lord's temple. So 2 Kings is talking about money brought to the Lord's temple, census money. We're not talking about that here in Leviticus 27. Money from vows, that would be from a peace offering, a thank offering. A thank offering, which is a peace offering, a vow offering, or a free will offering. Those are things brought to the temple in connection with other sacrifices and other and for other reasons, but here at the end in 2 Kings 12:4 says, and all money voluntarily given for the Lord's temple. So you see there were voluntary donations given the temple, and this is what's being talked about here in Leviticus 27. Now we have a very difficult problem in verse 2. Let me read you the NASB translation. Speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, when a man makes a difficult vow, he shall be valued according to your valuation of persons belonging to the Lord. He shall be valued. Now, the problem with that is that it sounds like the man is making a gift of himself to the temple, and so he gets himself value. But that can't be what it is. It most probably is not what it is. There's ways you can stretch it to make it sound like, to make it be that. But the he there is translated differently in so many versions that I think that this is the best way to look at it. It should be when a man makes a difficult vow, the priest shall value it according to the valuation of persons, according to the way you assess value, which we'll talk about in a minute. The NIV translates this passage, if anyone makes a special vow to dedicate persons to the Lord by asking equivalent values, not he shall or he shall be valued. The priest makes the special vow. Adam Clark says about verse 2 that, quote, the verse is short and obscure. Well, all of that is complicated by the difficulty of the translation, but if we use the Holman Christian Study Bible, which is what I should have done to start with, so there wouldn't be any question, Leviticus 27:2-3, speak to the Israelites and tell them, when someone makes a special vow to the Lord that involves the assessment of people, if the assessment concerns a male from 20 to 60 years old, your assessment is 50 silver shekels. And then you don't have the problem of saying that the offeror is valued. He shall be valued. Well, that makes no sense. The Holman Christian Study Bible just avoids the problem completely. But none of the other the modern translations do, so that makes it difficult. Now, what kind of persons might be offered to the temple? The offeror could offer himself. He could offer his children. He could offer his slaves. The NIV Study Bible says, possibly to give slaves to the service of the temple, but more likely to offer oneself or a member of one's family. Adam Clark says it's to offer souls, which is normally people, but Clark says that could be a living creature, which would include a beast. I don't think so. I think we're talking about people here. Now, this assessment, the reason they had to make an assessment of the value of the person offered to the temple is that only Levites could work in the temple. And if you were from Judah and you offered your son and dedicated him to the temple, well, he can't work in the temple. He's not a Levite. So he would have to be redeemed for money. He have to be the voluntary donation would have to be commuted into an equivalent value. So now we're going to look at that equivalent value, Leviticus 27, verses 3 through 7. If your valuation is of the male from 20 years, even to 60 years old, then your valuation shall be 50 shekels of silver after the shekel of the sanctuary. Or if it is a female, then your valuation shall be 30 shekels. If it be from 5 years, even to 20 years old, then your valuation for the male shall be 20 shekels, and for the female, 10 shekels. But if they are from a month, even up to 5 years old, then your valuation shall be 5 shekels of silver for the male, and for the female, your valuation shall be 3 shekels of silver. If they are from 60 years old and upward, if it is a male, then your valuation shall be 15 shekels, and for the female, 10 shekels. All right, here is what the people who were dedicated or consecrated to the temple were valued at, so that the person making the dedication could pay the equivalent amount of money rather than give up his person, who could not work in the temple, especially if it was a woman, a girl, that wouldn't work either. And also if they were in the wrong tribe, that wouldn't work. So this is the value that the priest was to put on these voluntary dedications of people. Now, we'll notice something, first of all, that in every age bracket, there's 1, 2, 3, 4 age brackets. 1 month to 5 years, bracket 1. 5 to 20 years, bracket 2. 20 to 60 years, bracket 3. So over 60 years, bracket 4. We see that the male price is higher than the female price. Now, does that mean males are intrinsically more valuable in God's eyes than women? Of course it does not. It just means the amount of work they could do, especially in the temple, would be more because they were stronger, and a lot of that stuff that needed to be done back then was based on strength, much less so now because of technology. But back then, there was not a lot of advanced technology, and so they needed muscle power, and so their labor was valued higher. That's the first thing we see. The next thing we see, that for both male and female, as you go up the bracket, starting at the youngest, 1 month to 5 years, the value is low. 5 to 20 years, it's higher. 20 to 60 years, it's higher even still. Ah, but after you get to 60 years, it drops back down again. Not as low as 1 month to 5 years, but nevertheless lower than the adult age, the teenage and the adult age brackets. Why? Well, that's because when people get old, they retire. They're not as worth as much on the labor market. I know how that is. And so the redemption value goes down. The age bracket in which the values of both males and females was the lowest was the 1 month to 5 years, because little kids don't do too much work. Now, they do have future potential. They might grow up and do some work, but that's in the future. You have to discount their value back to the present when they're little tiny kids. So all that makes a lot of sense. Now, some people have tried to explain something else about this. If you make a table out of these age brackets, age bracket first column male, second column female, third column, and then the fourth column, the female slash male ratio, we'll see that in the age bracket of 1 month to 5 years, a young girl's value was 60% of the males. But when we get to teenage years, 5 to 20 years, or youth in teenage years, 5 to 20 years, the female-to-male ratio is this. The female is worth 50% of the male's labor. She's actually worth more percentage-wise in 1 month to 5 years than she is in the 5 to 20-year bracket, in which case she's only worth half as much labor. When she gets to be in the 20 to 60 years, that's the working span bracket, her value jumps back up to 60% of the male's bracket. And then when she retires, her value hops all the way up to 67% of the male's value. Now, I've read some speculations as to why that is. They don't seem completely persuasive to me. But let me give a stab at it. Let me just throw this out for some ideas. Over 60 years, why is the woman's value the highest relative to the man? Because the man is weak. His physical strength is not as dominant as it was before, not as strong as it was before. And also, the woman by then is a little experienced and she can handle household type things, and so her value is worth more. Now, of course, we've got to think labor, this is valuing labor where? In the household, in the market, or in the sanctuary? That's another question. I guess if she was in the sanctuary, she'd be cooking. They had a lot of cooking going on, a lot of storing, a lot of household activities, and so her value would be higher than the man's, who was now old and got arthritis and can't pick things up and so forth. Now, in the 5 to 20-year-old bracket, her value is 50%, but it hops up to, in the 20 to 60-year-old bracket, her value hops up to 60% of the value of the male, and that's because she's actually working now between 20 and 60. She can do things, whereas when she's a teenager, she can't. So that somewhat makes sense. I don't understand why in the 1 month to 5-year bracket, she's worth more than when she's a child or a teenager. She's worth more as a baby than as a child or a teenager. That doesn't make sense. So I can't explain that exactly. Might be an interesting speculation for a PhD thesis. We go now to Leviticus 27, verse 8. But if one is too poor to pay the assessment, he must present the person before the priest, and the priest will set a value for him. The priest will set a value for him according to what the one making the vow can afford. So if you dedicated your child or your slave to the temple, and you were too poor to pay the valuation of it when you wanted to redeem this child or slave from the service to the temple, and you couldn't pay according to this amount right here. And I didn't mention the amounts too much in the previous several verses, but let me do it now. The male going up the age brackets is 5 shekels, 20 shekels, 50 shekels, and 15 shekels, and the females with 3 shekels, 10 shekels, 30 shekels, and 10 shekels. So the amount according to gender was fixed, but if a poor person couldn't handle that, he could redeem his slave according to whatever the priest set the value, and the priest would set the value according to the ability of the redeemer to pay. We go down to Leviticus 27:9-13. Now, if it is an animal, we're switching now from people to animals being dedicated to the temple. Now, if it is an animal of the kind which men can present as an offering, and of course that's the herd and the flock. The herd is the cows, the flocks is goats and sheep. So if a bull or a cow or a male goat or a female goat, nanny goat or a billy goat, or a sheep, which is a ewe or a lamb, If they are presented as an offering to the Lord, this is a voluntary gift. Any such that one gives to the Lord shall be holy. And that means it's used by the priest, by the temple, and nobody else. That's what it means to say it's holy. Verse 10, he, the offerer, shall not replace it or exchange it, a good for a bad or bad for a good. And, or if he does exchange animal for animal, then both it and its substitute shall become holy. Now what that means is, let's say you give a nice lamb and you say, oh, I got a cheaper lamb, I want to give that one, I want to get my good one back. Well, and you do it, and the priest agrees to it, which he shouldn't do, but if he does, well, now Somebody needs to enforce the law and say, no, you have to give up both of your sheep now. You've dedicated them both. Now, it also says if you do that the other way, you give a good sheep for a bad sheep. Now, why you would do that, I don't know. Maybe you got some kind of emotional attachment to that bad sheep that you gave away. But for whatever reason, you can't switch out your offerings, your special dedicatory offerings to the temple. If it's a animal, a sacrificial animal, you can't switch them out. If you try it, then both animals are dedicated to the temple and you can't get either one of them out. Verse 11, if, however, it is an unclean animal, that's an animal that's not a cow, sheep, or goat, if it is any unclean animal of the kind which men do not present as an offering to the Lord, then he shall place the animal before the priest. The priest shall value it as either good or bad, as you, the priest, value it, so it shall be. But if he should ever wish to redeem it, that's the offeror, then he shall add 1/5 to your valuation. So if it's a non-sacrificial offering type animal, like a camel or a donkey, you can give the animal to the tabernacle and let the priest use the animal. Maybe the priest needs a donkey to ride on, or maybe the priest could sell the camel or donkey and use the money to help support the temple. But if he hasn't sold it and the offerer wishes to redeem it, he can get it back, but he's got to pay a 20% restocking fee, if you will, 20% extra to the valuation. Now, let's distinguish these non-sacrificial animals from the sacrificial animals. If the priest was given a sacrificial animal, bull, lamb, or goat, if he was, the priest could sell it to another Israelite so that other Israelite could use it for one of his sacrifices, and the priest could use the money for the upkeep of the temple. But now, if he receives a non-sacrificial animal, the priest could sell it same way, but of course, the person buying it couldn't sacrifice it in the temple. He would have to use it for whatever purposes you use a camel or a donkey for, or whatever, or a deer, whatever it was. Now in verse 9, let me go back to verse 9. It says that, or verse 10, it says, he shall not replace it. This is an offering. An animal given for an animal that's used for sacrifices is given to the priesthood, and then the offerer shall not replace it or exchange it. Now what does that mean? It means both animals belong to the temple, and the offerer couldn't get his animal back. It also means he couldn't get his animal redeemed. He couldn't pay money to the priest plus 20% and get it back. Now, it doesn't say that. Verse 11 allows for the redemption of unclean animals, where if you give it to the priest, you can get it back from the priest by paying a 20% fee. It doesn't say that about sacrificial animals. Ellicott says they could not be redeemed, and that makes sense to me. Once you give it, that's it. You can't get it back. Now, these animals, if they were the type that could be used for sacrifices, the priest could actually use them for sacrifices. For example, a morning and evening sacrifice that had to be done every day, the priest could just use the animals for that. Or they could be sold to support the priest, or they could be sold for money to repair the sanctuary. Now, what's the purpose of this idea that you can't redeem or take back an animal, a sacrificial animal that you give to the sanctuary? Why? According to the commentator Benson, he says, quote, to preserve a reverence. The purpose of this is to, quote, to preserve a reverence toward things once consecrated that they might not return to common uses. That makes a lot of sense to me. Now, what is this 1/5 penalty? What's the purpose of it? If I give a donkey to the priest, he lets me redeem it for the value of the donkey, but I got to pay him an extra 20% to get my donkey back. Why? Gill and Clark say, here's purpose number one, to avoid hasty, rash offerings. If you know you give something to the temple, but you can just get it right back by going and say, hey, priest, I want my donkey back. Well, that's not good. And so knowing that you would have to pay a 20% premium to get it back would slow you down and prevent you from making a rash offering. Purpose number two, to cover accidental undervaluation by the priest, as John Gill says. Now, you know, there's no real bargaining going over here as in a marketplace. The priest sets the value, and that's what you pay. As John Gill points out, the priest is less likely than the owner to know the more precise value. He might set the value too low, and so then you get your donkey back at too cheap a price, and then you really haven't given the donkey to the temple. You've kind of shortchanged the temple, so the 20% premium will take care of that. The priest is not likely to miss or to understate the value by more than 20%. All right, this is the second reason for the 1/5 20% penalty, redemption penalty. Adam Clark gives another reason. Reason number three, let's say I give a donkey to the priest. I find out that the donkey market has skyrocketed. People are paying a fortune for donkeys now. And I say, I think I want my donkey back. The value of donkeys has risen 10%. So I go to the priest and say, give me my donkey back, and then I go to the market and sell my donkey and make a nice 10% profit. Well, if I have to pay 20% to get it back, I won't make a 10% profit, and that'll keep me from jerking stuff out from the priest just because there's a fluctuation in the market value of the good donated, of the animal donated. We go now to Leviticus 27, verses 14 through 15. Now, if a man consecrates his house, we're moving now from animals to houses. We've done people, we've done animals, now we're doing houses. Now, if a man consecrate his house as holy to the Lord, then the priest shall value it as either good or bad, means high or low, as the priest values it, so it shall stand. Yet if the one who consecrates it should wish to redeem his house, then he shall add 1/5 of your valuation price to it, so that it may be his. Now, the first thing I noticed here is this is not a objective real estate assessor evaluating this. The person who's receiving the good evaluates it, and he knows that if it's going to be redeemed, there's going to be a 20% penalty. What is the incentive to keep a priest from valuating the value of the house fairly high so that he can be sure to keep the house? Well, I don't know how that was handled. I guess it was assumed that the priest would be honest about this. If any reason you wanted your house back, you had to pay the 20% penalty to get it back for the same reasons if you had to pay 20% to get your donkey or your ass back. Now, we mentioned animals and houses. John Gill says this would include all other personal property besides animals. A plow, let's say, for example, just by extension, by logical, analogical reasoning, you would get there. Now, of course, you might ask, what's the priest going to do with a house? Well, some of them might live in it. But they could also sell the house or rent the house and use the money to support the sanctuary or to support the priest. Now, here's an interesting question. I mentioned that John Gill said by extension, by analogical reason, that all other personal property besides animals would be included in this section about assessing the value of a house. But a house is not personal property, at least not in English law, is what I'm used to. But notice that the value of the house is not discounted according to the year of Jubilee. So the value of the house must have been considered personal property distinct from the land, which is very strange. We go down to Leviticus 27, verses 16 through 18. Again, if a man consecrates to the Lord part of the fields of his own property, then your valuation shall be proportionate to the seed needed for it, a homer of barley seed at 50 shekels of silver. If he consecrates his field as of the year of Jubilee, according to your valuation, it shall stand. If he consecrates his field after the Jubilee, however, then the priest shall calculate the price for him proportionate to the years that are left until the year of Jubilee, means of the next year of Jubilee, and it shall be deducted from your valuation. First of all, verse 16, if a man consecrates to the Lord part of the fields of his own property, it was not lawful for a man to vow his whole estate, as Adam Clark and commentator Benson say. Now, I don't know if I don't think it says that anywhere in the law, but there must have been a rabbinic law somewhere that said, no, you don't give all your family, all your property away in order to enrich God's sanctuary. You don't leave your family destitute. That reminds me of the medieval 13th century mortmain laws. I think they started in Edward I's reign, late 1200s. People were giving so much money to monasteries, they weren't taking care of their descendants. And so Parliament passed a bill, mortmain, says you're not going to do that. Even today, or at least in the past, in our wills, I know in South Carolina at times you couldn't give away more than, well, you had to give a statutory share, 1/6 of your personal goods to your wife. You couldn't just give it to your girlfriend or to whoever you wanted to protect the family. Well, at any rate, and besides, even if there wasn't such a law, nobody is going to do that in the normal course of business. They're not going to give all of their fields away to the priest. So it'll be a part of the fields. And this is a certain kind of property, his own property. That means his tribal property, the property that was distributed to his family when Joshua entered into the land and divided the whole land up by tribes. And if, say, 50, 60 years have gone by, then a Jubilee has happened, the land has been sold, but it comes back at Jubilee. It always comes back to the original tribal owner. So this would be a part of a tribal field owned by the donor. The laws are going to be different if it's a purchased field, which we'll see in a minute. Now, you give the field, you want to get it back. You've got to value the field. The priest does. Well, real estate's a little bit harder to appraise than a donkey or a camel or something like that. So here's the way they did it. They say, okay, I see your field. We know how much barley cost. We know how much barley seed is going to take to plant that field. And let's say it takes one homer of barley, and we know a barley, and well, it's set here in Leviticus, the homer of barley is worth 50 shekels of silver. Well, let's say it takes 2 homers of barley to plant that field. Well, then if you're going to redeem this field, you've got to pay 100 shekels, 50 per homer. So there was an objective way of valuing the field, of assessing the value of the field. And then, of course, you do your typical discounting. If you bought the field and there's 50 years to the year of Jubilee, you pay the full amount of barley's worth, if you would. But then if it's the second year after the Jubilee with 48 to go, or the third year with 47 to go, you discount the value of the field by roughly 1/50th or 1/49th of the value till you get to the all the way to the next Jubilee period. Then the price goes all the way back up to full price again, a homer of barley, 50 shekels of silver, or however many homers it takes to plant your field. What is a homer, by the way, a homer of barley? John Gill has an interesting comment on this. He says, quote, "We must carefully distinguish between an omer beginning with an O and an homer beginning with an H. Not observing this has led some learned men into mistakes in their notes on this place, for an omer was 1/10th part of an ephah, and an ephah is but the 10th part of a homer. So going from small to large dry unit, omer is the smallest, ephah is in the middle, and homer is the biggest." And it's a metric system here, 10th, 10th, and 10th. Homer the small, ephah in the middle, homer at the top. A homer is about 5 bushels, according to the Holman Christian Study Bible. Matthew Henry says that the 50 shekels of silver that you pay for a homer of barley is a small price. I don't have a feel for shekels back in the ancient world. I don't know how he knows that, but he says that's a fairly moderate price. So the priest is not going to get rich off of people donating fields to the tabernacle. Now, there's one thing that's not said here. Well, here it is. I'm sorry. Going to verses 19 and 21 about the 20% penalty. Verse 19, "If the one who consecrated the field decides to redeem it, he must add 1/5 to the assessed value, and the field will transfer back to him." So you value the field, add 20% to that, you get the field back if you want to redeem it. Verse 20, "But if he does not redeem the field, or if," I'm going to switch to the New Living Translation here, "or if the priest has sold it to another man, it is no longer redeemable." Now, that switch to the New Living Translation is a translation problem, and it's a big one, so I'll talk about it in just a minute. But let me read verse 20 again. "But if he does not redeem the field, if the offerer or the donor does not redeem the field, or if the priest has sold it to another man, it is no longer redeemable." Well, of course, if the person redeeming the field doesn't redeem it, and it's talking about all the way to the time of the year of Jubilee, the year of Jubilee is going to redeem, it's going to revert back to the priest. Verse 21, "When the field is released in the Jubilee, it will be holy to the Lord like a field permanently set apart. It becomes the priest's property." So let me read verse 20 again. "If the donor does not redeem the field, i.e. to the year of Jubilee, in which case it's going to revert back to the priest, or if the priest has sold it to another man, well, the donor can't redeem it. If it's sold to another man before the year of Jubilee, that cuts off the donor's right of redemption. He's lost the field. And then at the year of Jubilee, the field will revert from the third-party purchaser back to the priest. Now, I've thought of a little problem about setting the value, assessing the value of the field. Do you assess it at 1/5 of the original non-discounted value, as if it was sold right after the year of Jubilee? Or is the redemption price 1/5 of the price as discounted from the year of Jubilee? Let's say it's 25 years later. Well, then the land's going to be half as much. And so is it 1/5 of the half value or 1/5 of the full value? Well, I think it would be 1/5 of the discounted value, because that's when the property was given to the priest, and that's what it was worth at that time, discounted by 25 years. Now, let's look at verse 20 again. I used a part of the New Living Translation in order to explain this. But let me read you the Holman Christian Study Bible, and I will tell you that this is also the KJV, this is also the NASB, this is all the modern translations, and they don't make any sense. They say, "But if he does not redeem the field, or if he has sold it to another man," not the priest, but "he has sold it to another man." So if he does not redeem the field will be the donor, or if he, the donor, has sold it to another man. Well, why would the donor sell the property to another man? He's already given it to the priest. How could he sell it to another man? Well, one option is to say that he was a crook. This is Ellicott's solution. He says the donor vows the field of the priest and surreptitiously sells the land to a third party. And therefore, since he's done that, come Jubilee time, he loses his right of redemption and the property goes to the priest. I don't believe Ellicott's right there. The answer is that the he there has sold it to another man refers to the priest. Now, Matthew Henry says so, or at least mentions this option. So does John Gill. They affirm that. They say that's what it is. And Benson does also. Let me read his quote. For preventing ambiguity, instead of if he have sold the field, it ought to be rendered if the priest have sold, as in the Arabic version, or that's switching the value of the subject from he to the priest, but you can also make it passive. Or, Benson continues, or if it be sold to another, as in the Vulgate, for the he cannot refer to the owner of our the land, as our version makes it. No, it can't. You can do the Ellicott move and say, well, he did it crookedly, but that's not likely going to happen. Now, to show you how Benson and Gill and Clark, Gill and Matthew Henry are most probably accurate, I'm going to give you five different translations that back up the idea it's the priest giving the dedicated land to another third-party purchaser, the priest, not the donor. Here's the New Living Translation. But if you decide not to redeem the field, or if the field is sold to someone else by the priest, it can never be redeemed, so the priests are doing it. Here's the New Century Version. If the person does not buy back the field, if it's not redeemed, or if it is sold to someone else, doesn't say who sold it, but it's assumed to be the priest, the first person cannot ever buy it back. New Revised Standard Version, but if the field is not redeemed, or if it has been sold to someone else, passive, doesn't say by whom, but it's presumed to be the priest, it shall no longer be redeemable. Here's the Catholic Douay Rheims Bible. And if he will not redeem it, but it be sold to any other man, doesn't say by whom, but it doesn't say by the donor either, so we assume it to be the priest. He that vowed it may not redeem it anymore. Here's the complete Jewish Bible. Here's a Jewish translation. If the seller does not wish to redeem the field, or if, brackets, the treasurer for the Kohanim, this is some Jewish financial institution, which I don't understand, but if the seller does not wish to redeem the field, or if the treasurer has already sold the field to somebody else, in other words, somebody acting as an agent for the priest, has already sold the field to someone else, it can no longer be redeemed. So, despite the fact that the NASB, the NIV, the Holman Christian Study Bible, the King James, and even the Young's Literal Translation has sold it to another man, it doesn't make any sense. It's the priest sold it to another man. Once that happens, the right of redemption on the part of the donor is cut off. Now, in verse 21, this field, once the year of Jubilee is reached and the property reverts to the priest, is holy to the Lord. Now, some translations have it devoted to the Lord. I like the translation better, devoted. The King James has devoted. The NIV has devoted. That comes from the Hebrew charam, if I said that right, which I probably didn't. That word means devoted. As Adam Clark says, this is a thing so devoted to God as never more to be capable of being redeemed. In other words, it's permanently now in the priest's possession. Now remember now, this is only true of land that is sold by somebody who owned it from his original tribe, not land that somebody might have bought from another person who might very well have belonged to another tribe. It's not talking about that. We'll see in a minute different rules for that. That land reverts back to the original owner. So let's say that donor buys some land, and donor is in the tribe of Benjamin. He buys some land from Mr. Judean. So, and Mr. Judean's land was his, that was his original tribal land. So donor has some land that belongs to the tribe of Judea, and it would go back to the tribe of Judea, back to his seller at the year of Jubilee. So donor, Mr. Benjamin there, dedicates, consecrates the land to the temple, gives it to the temple. Now the priest can use it until the year of Jubilee, but at the year of Jubilee it goes back to the original seller, Mr. Judean. It goes back to Judea. Now I'm just speculating as to what the difference is. Well, if you think about it, a lot of people buy property belonging to people in another tribe. Let's say I've done that and I know that I'm not going to get that land back at Jubilee. It's going to revert back to the original tribal owner. So, hey, let me just give it to the priest. I give it to the priest. The priest says, hot dog, it's mine at Jubilee. I get to keep it. Well, if everybody did that, the original tribal allocations would get screwed up pretty bad. In fact, the priesthood would have so much land, it would probably get to be oppressive. So the amount of land flowing into the priesthood is fixed at that which is given from original tribal land. Now, that limitation is a limitation, but we need to remember that it is possible that some land could be alienated from the original tribal owners, which is easy to forget. the priests sometimes ended up with land that was not originally allocated to them. These priests did all right. They had a lot of people giving them stuff all the time, in addition to the sacrifices that were given to them. So they were taken care of by the temple service, not by land. They weren't given any land when they came into the land. So now let's go to Leviticus 27, verse 22 through 25, and we'll finish up this first half of Leviticus. If a person consecrates to the Lord a field he has purchased that is not part of his inherited landholding, now here we're talking about land that is bought from a person in a different tribe, then the priest will calculate for him the amount of the assessment up to the year of Jubilee, and the person will pay the assessed value on that day as a holy offering to the Lord. Of course, all valuations is done according to the year of Jubilee. If there's 25 years left, then the value of the land is half. And of course, I'm assuming it's valued by how many homers it would take to plant the field, and each homer's worth 50 shekels. Let's say it's one homer. One field is takes one homer to plant it. 50 shekels is the valuation. There's 25 years to go to the year of Jubilee, so we cut that in half, and the value of the land is 25 shekels. And so then the donor, if he wanted to get his land back, he had to pay 25 shekels plus the 20%. Now there's no, well, I said it plus 20%. There's no 20% mentioned here. It was mentioned for the land which belonged to a person who received that land as part of the original distribution of land, his original tribal homeland, if you will. He has to pay 20% to get it back. But there's no 20% here if you give purchase land. Let's say you purchase land from a different tribe, or even your own tribe for that matter. But to make it easier, let's say you purchase it from a different tribe. You can redeem it at just the value of the land with no extra 20%. Now, Matthew Poole, in order to explain that, says the reason is that purchased land is less valuable and less durable than inherited land, because the purchased land is going to go back to another family at Jubilee time, but inherited land from your own tribal forefathers, that will not go back to another family, and so therefore, but it'll come back to you, the donor, so therefore the land is more valuable, therefore he's got to pay more to get it back out. Now, the money used to redeem this land, it, as I said before, can be used for repairs of the temple, lots of uses for it, to buy supplies for the temple. They needed implements, all kinds of stuff. They needed to repair the cloth, things that ripped. They had to fix the temple clothes, or the priest clothes. There's all kind of stuff they needed money for. And all of the valuation for all these redemptions was according to the standard sanctuary shekel. Verse 25 says, a shekel was kept in the sanctuary as a standard measure. So nobody would get the idea of debasing the coinage, if you will. They didn't have coins, but cheating according to the weights and measures of the silver. One last point before I go. Here's some issues in calculating the assessed value of all these things, the lands, the houses. Well, no, just in calculating the land, because with assessing the value of the land, you got to worry about the year of Jubilee, not so with houses and animals and people, but with the land, because the land reverted back to the owner every 50 years, it decreased the value of the land the further you were away from the previous Jubilee and the closer you were to the upcoming Jubilee. Now, this is just something I thought about. What happens if you decide to buy the land in year 7? Do you discount 43 years? The 43rd, or say 43 years of the cycle that's left? But when you buy the land in the Sabbath year, the purchaser can't use the land because it's the seventh year. Land's got to lie fallow. So should you discount the value of the Sabbath? You can't discount all the other Sabbaths, but if you purchase it on a Sabbath, it seems like it would be unfair. I suspect that all that was taken into account and the value was lowered accordingly, but I would have to ask a good Jewish lawyer that. I am just at the top of all this legal stuff in Leviticus. I'm sure Jewish rabbis are much deeper than me. Ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished the first part of Leviticus 27. In our next audio, the last part of Leviticus 27 and the last part of the whole book of Leviticus 27. Praise the Lord, we're almost finished. I'm going to call that one Things Which Cannot Be Redeemed. There's some exceptions as to why you can redeem property if you give it to the temple. So I hope you stay tuned for that scintillating discussion, and I hope you enjoyed this audio more than I did. See you next time.